You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
The Niger Delta on the south coast of Nigeria is one of the largest oil-producing regions in the world. The instability of the Niger Delta has escalated over recent years due to clashes between local militants fighting for a voice and a share of the oil revenue and an oppressive government backed by multinational petroleum companies protecting their own interests. Now the illness of President Umaru Yar'Adua has brought a change of power in Nigeria. One question that arises is, what are the implications of this change in government for the conflict in the Niger Delta? Sandy Siofi is a documentary filmmaker and activist who became intimately familiar with the situation in the Niger Delta when she produced her film Sweet Crude, and she joins me now on the line. Welcome again to Red Eye, Sandy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And the Nigerian vice president and now acting president, Goodluck Jonathan, recently dissolved the Nigerian cabinet. What's the significance of that?
Well, I think, first of all, for people who don't know the context, Goodluck Jonathan is actually an Ijaw man from the south of the country. So the phrase that people would use in Nigeria is that he's the first son of the soil who has been in national office since the country has been a democratic country. And in fact, prior to that, just for a history lesson, that region of the Niger Delta was the region that was deeply embattled during the Biafran War, and as many as 2 million people died in that war. So this is a conflict that has been in many ways sort of orchestrated first by colonial powers and now by corporate powers, and the battle lines are similar to the ones that have been there for decades. So Goodluck Jonathan being the acting president is extremely significant for people from the south who have never felt that they have any representation in the government that decides their fate. So on the one hand, that's seen as a very positive step. I thought it was typical and disappointing that his actions were reported as if it was sort of a coup, because that's simply not true. He was the democratically elected, now, I mean, let's be fair, electoral fraud is significant, but the people of the country certainly gave over to the idea that Yar'Adua was the president and Goodluck Jonathan's vice president for the last 2 years. And so when he has become acting president, it was a very sort of traditional, typical, and regular thing to do. In fact, the same thing would happen and has happened in the U.S., if the vice president becomes president. It happened when JFK was killed, that when the vice president takes over, you establish your own government to get things done. And many of the most reasonable voices on the ground in the Niger Delta were actually calling for Goodluck Jonathan to do just that. So it seemed, you know, to me, maybe even a tad racist, that the way that it was reported was, Goodluck Jonathan dissolves cabinet, changes government. Well, actually, he was doing his job. So I think it was seen as a good step by the people, by the forces for peaceful political resolution.
You mentioned that he's the first president to come from the Niger Delta region. Does he have any conflicting interests with regards to that origin, or is that simply wholeheartedly an indication of sympathy and willingness to address the needs and interests of the people living in the Niger Delta?
Well, it would be impossible for any president in that country to be seen as not carrying with him or her, though right now it's hard to imagine it wouldn't be a him, but it would be impossible for any president not to be seen as carrying conflicting interests, because the country is very much divided along north-south lines, and it's the conventional wisdom is that it's divided along Muslim-Christian lines, and it happens to be the case that all of the oil resides under the feet of the Christians in the south. And when anywhere between 80 and 90% of the entire wealth of the nation comes from that one product, you can imagine the danger and the violence when the north was set up with more of the power and more of the guns by their British colonists, and then the powers that took over after that, being the corporate powers, would continue to keep those dictators from the north pit against the south, because if the people in the south had ever gained real political power, then perhaps the oil companies couldn't behave in the manner that they were. I mean, I'm sort of in some ways being very reductionist, but just to give you the basic battle lines. So sure, there'll be those who will say that Good Luck Jonathan comes to office with conflicting interests, but just like someone from the north would come to office with an interest to potentially suppress the south, I think he could overcome those. I think the most promising aspect of that are some of the advisors he has near him, most notably Oronto Douglas, who history would give us that Oronto Douglas, first of all, was the attorney for Ken Saro-Wiwa, the human rights activist who was killed in 1995, who organized and fought against Shell Oil, and many people around the world knew him. Oronto was his attorney, and since then, Oronto has been a major voice for the environmental and human rights in the Niger Delta. Now, Oronto is very close to the presidency right now, and I think some people find that a very hopeful step.
The conflicts between Muslims and Christians, there were clashes just recently in the city of Josh, are really played up in our media. Do you think that's really a reflection of realities, or those conflicts and the attention they get are a cover, really, in the media for other issues which are not being explained to us?
Well, first of all, the conflicts were bloody and brutal and horrible, and those things are true. And, I mean, I have friends on the ground with whom I correspond, and I can tell you that for people who live in Nigeria, it is a frightening time. There's a sort of fever pitch of discontent that some people even liken to American discontent with government. There's just an extraordinary recognition and anger at how corrupt most of the Nigerian governments have been. And it's true. It's all true. I mean, when you have the resource curse, as many people call it, and that level of guns and vested interests playing around with your country, trying to establish civil society is next to impossible. After all, it's very difficult to do even when you don't have those factors. So I think, to me, the more disturbing thing about the way the story is told is that it's told utterly devoid of any content of oil. It's told as if it's all about these rabid people who are fighting each other over Christian and Muslim issues. Well, certainly on the surface, if you interviewed those people, that might be what they'd say to you. But the ways in which their ethnic and religious lives have been manipulated to create conflict, which is actually about the resources and actually about the haves and have-nots, is a sad tale that we could tell again and again all over the planet. It's very much that the underpinning of the conflict has to do with who's in power, who's jockeying for a position for the next election, who's greasing whose palm, who's actually taking a cut for quote-unquote security from an oil company, even though the oil companies can never be directly implicated in creating that kind of violence. These are things that have been going on for decades, and in some cases are actually finally being tried in U.S. courts under what's called alien tort law. There have finally been two cases in the last 2 years where Chevron and Shell have been held accountable for their, albeit tertiary, but their relationship to violence on the ground in Nigeria.
We know from other parts of the world that American foreign policy and oil interests are intimate family. What's American foreign policy vis-a-vis the Nigeria?
Well, it's a good question, because the truth is it's really been shifting. And, you know, a lot of folks make the assumption that it's shifting for the better under Obama, and I'd like to make that assumption, but I think that would be, I'd be jumping to a conclusion, and that would be sloppy of me. Currently, I can tell you that the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, did travel to Nigeria this past year, and that was the first time in a very long time that a U.S. Secretary of State has done that. I can tell you that we have at least outwardly been calling for the Nigerian government to negotiate with the militancy in the south, which is called MEND, or the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. At least our open position has been a bit better, meaning that we've been pushing for peaceful civil solution to the conflict. Now, that being said, the disturbing thing about what the Secretary of State did when she was there was essentially focus on all of the ways in which the people on the ground in local communities are corrupt. And while that's true, that's an easy out for the Americans to just discuss what the Nigerians are doing wrong, when in fact we've played a huge role in supporting the thugs to begin with, the original thugs and the ones who are a far greater aspect of the human rights abuses in the country. So on what I would say is a hopeful note and what people can push for is that there are some U.S. senators on the Foreign Relations Committee who have become very, very good on this issue and are pushing toward what we would call sort of third-party monitored talks, and they're pushing for the international community to play a different role, and the role being that local people are simply asking to have the control over the environment and the amount of the revenue that they deserve, which is, again, an issue that you could play all over the world, including in Canada, including in Alberta, including relative to tar sands. But if local people really had their say, it would be very unlikely that you'd be pulling tar sands out of the ground. Well, there are some communities in the Niger Delta that I think would vote similarly.
You were in Washington, D.C. last week to meet with some political people. I'm wondering what happened there.
Well, some good news. We actually had many policymakers from the World Bank, the IMF, the UN, the U.S. State Department came to a screening at Johns Hopkins and stayed for hours to discuss what kind of multilateral approach there might be toward a peaceful solution in the Niger Delta. And to explain what the stakes are here, I mean, we're talking about the possibility of 20 million people being displaced, 2 to 3 million people dying. And if that, you know, doesn't grab people's attention, for the U.S., it would be upwards of 12 to 15% of our oil shut off. That gets people's attention. It's a very underreported region, and that's another, you know, an hour-long conversation why that is. But I would say that the World Bank right now has a role, a very specific role they can play, and I think, you know, I could be being Pollyanna, but I think they were listening. They've been funding Chevron, Shell, and several oil companies over the years to reduce gas flaring, and those companies have not lived up to those deadlines. And it's been high time for a long time that the World Bank find them and hold them accountable for that relationship. And I think that's going to finally happen in 2010. I think that gas flaring deadlines might actually be met by 2012, and that's a significant cause of the violence. It's a significant cause of what happens on the ground to people environmentally, and it's a significant cause of greenhouse gases for the world. So that's no small thing. In addition to that, we certainly met with many of the people who are in backdoor conversations about who the U.S. supports and doesn't support in terms of the next presidential election in Nigeria, and that will signal to people on the ground whether or not we are now going to actually call for a real democracy in that country. And I, you know, before that sounds too neo-colonial, I just want to make sure people understand the U.S. has already monkeyed around so seriously with that country that there's a way in which you can't just simply have nothing to do with it, even though you're buying, you know, something like 50% of their oil, and pretend that you're not influencing their, you know, the foreign policy.
Well, it's been very informative speaking with you this morning. Thanks very much for taking the time.
I appreciate that. I just wanted to tell you that the film will play again in Vancouver on April 24th at noon as part of the Projecting Change Film Festival at the Fifth Avenue Theaters.
Okay, April 24th. Thanks for mentioning that, too.
Okay, bye-bye.
I've been speaking with award-winning filmmaker and activist Sandy Siofi about the current situation in the Niger Delta. And if you'd like more information, you can also visit the website for her documentary called Sweet Crude. And the website is simply sweetcrudemovie.com.